Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking to economist Ronan Lyons. So, and we are going to get straight into it, Martin, because we've been looking forward to this conversation for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. We respect Ronan's views.
Absolutely.
Ronan's position.
Actually, we respect it. Everybody who comes on the podcast and actually puts their views forward gets a fair audience, I like to believe. And we like to, even if we have to talk often robustly. But reminder, live show, Sugar Club, please God, it happens early November. The link is in the bio. Get your tickets. Please buy some tickets. It would be really helpful if we could sell that out, because it's under restriction, so it's not a full capacity, and it's a lovely venue for a live podcast. It really is. Anyway, as I said, Ronan Lyons is on the line. Ronan, good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me on again.
Listen, I know there's a lot more we want to talk about, but I do want to touch on a couple of things from this week's budget. And one of the things that struck me is it's been lauded as a success that we've had this, you know, the borrowing requirement is nearly 14 billion less than we anticipated because of tax receipts and how well the economy has done and bounced back. And it's been put to us that this is, you know, the Pascal Donohue and Michael McGrath did such a good job of kind of keeping their cards close to their chest that the other ministers didn't know that there was this extra surplus there, and they've managed to bring in this what is considered a kind of fiscally prudent budget. Is that something that you've picked up on?
Yeah, I mean, the overall thing in the budget, I think generally, you know, politicians, and I'm not picking on any politicians, but often they get ascribed things that are not really to do with them or under their control. So the rebound in the economy this year is not the product. I mean, certainly a policymaker, if they were determined to, they could destroy it. Like, they could have made sure it didn't happen. But a lot of it is kind of it's the sort of underlying force in the economy. You put everyone sort of at home and give them not quite full income. A lot of people obviously had a huge shock to their income, but a lot of people were on more or less full pay at home, unable to spend. And then the next year you open up again. It's, you know, lots of countries around the world are experiencing the sort of not quite growing pains, but the supply chain challenges that come when you rebound as quickly as a lot of places have rebounded. And I think in the case of the government finances, you know, we had, you know, there's a great guy on Twitter, John O'Brien. He's sort of like, he's not political or ideological anyway. He just goes off and he finds interesting stats and puts them up. And I always kind of, it's one of my favorite Twitter accounts, because you never know what he's going to post next, but it's always going to be interesting. He had a chart this week at the day of the budget, and it was the deficit or surplus for the Irish government back to 1924, up through to the next couple of years with the forecasts and the budget. And, you know, we ran 50 years of deficits, which is impressive in its own way, from the 1940s to the 1990s. And, you know, having control of the public finances is an important ingredient in success. That doesn't mean that spending has to be austere, but what it does mean is that we need to know where the money's coming in and where it's being spent. And I think the real challenge, if I were Minister for Finance now, I'd be kind of, my worry would be not necessarily, I mean, the corporate tax stuff is changing and that's going to have an impact, but that's kind of model.
We'll get into that.
It's the fact that the increase in tax receipts over the last 5 years has been so concentrated in corporate tax receipts. That's not something you can plan on as being indefinite. And the mistake we made with our public finances in the early 2000s was relying on stamp duties and sort of transitory tax returns to make public permanent spending commitments. So you increase public servants' salaries, they expect that to last. And if your temporary tax revenues disappear, that's you've got a huge battle on your hands, as we found out 2008, 9, 10, 11, 12. So I think there's definitely some credit there. And in fairness, they're talking about being close to balance within a couple of years. Now, I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea of having a balanced budget. You need to have a balanced current account. Your capital account, like your investment in a growing country, you should be investing.
So Ronan, you've guessed what I want to get at. They're talking about a balanced budget by 2025. 5, I think, is what the talk is. And yet within the fiscal rules, we don't have to be in such a rush to get there. And we can continue to spend more money there's an additional 2.5 billion available that we didn't avail of. You know, in 2025, there's when you factor in the projections that you discussed, there's almost an additional 6 billion that could be used. But so the fiscal rules that we were told that we have to live within, we're in such a hurry to get there that we're going to get there years ahead of our European peers. And it just seems to me, maybe this is the wrong time to be putting the car into second gear, and maybe we should keep it in third and maybe even look at fourth every now and then.
Well, let me now come down on the other side and say, every good economist have two hands, on the one hand, on the other hand, right? So like, there's certainly no requirement to have a balanced budget. As I say, like, I'm a fan of having a balanced current account and using your capital account to make the investments the state needs to make to provide for the living that we'd like to have. That said, I don't think you should spend every last euro that you have available to you, I don't think you should commit to spend every last available euro, because you may end up in a system with capacity constraints. You don't drive up, like, if you think about how much you're getting and how much you're spending for what you're getting, you just end up pushing up the price, not pushing up the service you're getting. And if you look at the health system over the last 10 years, obviously you kind of let's stop pre-COVID, but the health system is a really good example of this. Every year spending was ramped up in healthcare, and every year healthcare came in even over what it had been provided for. But those overruns were then baked into future years. So if the increase in healthcare spending off the top of my head, I'm trying to remember the numbers, but say roughly something like 13 billion up to 20 billion, say. I might be wrong in the exact numbers, but it's something like that. Of that increase over the course of the 2010s, half of it was completely unplanned for and basically uncontrolled increases in prices, not increases in what we were actually getting for our money. So there's a worry that if you just commit to spend everything you can in any given year.
I'm not advocating for that. I'm just
I'm
just advocating for, let's look at the idea that these are the fiscal rules that we were told for, we have to play within, we nearly brought down the world and blah, blah, blah. These are the rules we have to play by. Let's just try and stick to them. Let's not try to be the best boy in class and maybe look at some of that capacity, because we'll get to it. There are challenges in other areas that we need to deal with, like other aspects of fixing, as you write about yourself, about fixing housing, actually getting more for our healthcare. And I think healthcare actually has returned some of its budget this year for the first time. And maybe that's to do with COVID spending or that was put aside. And it's, but either way, it's an outlier for once. Going to pause the podcast for a quick plug. We are live on November 10th in Dublin Sugar Club. We're going back live, all fingers crossed. And we are going to bring the podcast from across the platform. You'll see all the familiar faces, including myself, Rory, and the gang. And it will be a fun, informative, and I guarantee you, some laughs as well. So it's tickets are up right now on Eventbrite. So if you go to Eventbrite and check for Tortoise Shack, or you just click the link on the bottom of this podcast. Alternatively, if you are a patron supporter, go through that channel and it will simplify the process for you. It is, as I said, available on Eventbrite. Grab the tickets now, support this independent platform, and we hope to see lots of you there on November 10th in what is one of the best venues for podcasts in the country. Talk to you all very soon. I do think there's a really interesting conversation that's going to happen over the next couple of years in terms of what we do as a country and where we see that spending go. But I do want to move us on, because I suppose if I can really get to it, the genesis of this initial conversation was your piece in The Currency, which is, again, another great, we always recommend a lot of the stuff that comes out in The Currency. But you spoke about, and you raised the hackles of many a person who was well known in this parish, about anti-science and reasons to be cheerful for housing as opposed to being pessimistic. If I could ask you really quickly, if that's okay, can you give us your... give us your elevator pitch for why there's reasons to be cheerful and why you think the people on the other side of this are, as you termed, anti-science.
So what I mean by anti-scientific in relation to the housing debate, like, there was a specific claim made And it's sort of like the, I don't want this to be kind of like personal. It's not about particular individuals, but I do think particular arguments need to be taken head on. So there was a claim made about a development, a proposed development in Dublin 3, I think, that if it went ahead, that it would causally increase rents in existing properties in the area. And my piece about anti-science in the housing debate was, there is no empirical evidence to support that. In fact, the overwhelming consensus in the empirical literature on this is that when you build new rental accommodation, it lowers the rents in the existing rental stock. So there's lots of points of disagreement that I think are completely valid, right? I have a different take to some people in the housing policy debate around the fact that the government has certain standards for build to rent and other standards for build to own. That's legitimate. Like, you can have differences of opinion. Facts are stubborn things, as John Adams said, but you can't have your own set of facts. You can't make the claim, and especially if you're not trained in the area, you can't make the claim that, I wouldn't go into a debate in architecture and say, forget what you learned in architecture 101. Function doesn't follow form. Or I'm after doing the wrong way around there.
I think the listener gets what you're saying, and I can agree with you and yet disagree on the basis that when we look at electoral divisions within Dublin, for example, so let's pick Dublin 24, one of the electoral divisions where I think some of these build-to-rent units account for nearly 45% of beds, and they can set a floor for rents, in effect. You know,
but they can't, as in, if you have a lower quality rental offering than a build-to-rent two-bed, if you have a different type of two-bed that's not as attractive, you simply cannot charge the same price. What will set a floor, and I'm more than happy, I think we might actually have points of agreement on this, is if you've got a system like HAP, where HAP can come along and set a floor for the private rental market, and HAP can increase private market rents. The prevalence of HAP can be a big a determinant of private market rents. But if you're like somebody like me says, let supply fight amongst itself, right? Supply can come along and one bit of supply can fight another bit of supply, and what you end up with is lower rents. I'm not saying this simply out of Econ 101, right? This isn't a theoretical thing. This is an empirical thing. Like, I don't know if you saw the guys who won the, and they were all guys this year, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics.
I did.
And they've
been saying the same thing for a long time.
They won it for bringing rigorous, what are known as kind of identification strategies. What you want to do is you want to identify the causal effect of whatever, A on B, right? If you change minimum wage regulations, do you have a negative effect on employment? And they found no, actually. One of the authors found no. That this argument that minimum wages would somehow hinder those in, you know, on the cusp of employment, their empirical research said no. And the research I'm talking about in the housing debate, it's a research that's grown in particular over the last 5 years as our sources of data have improved. These aren't people who go imposing some sort of neoclassical version of economics on the data. What they're doing is they're saying, they ask the data. They say there's a theory here and there's a theory here. Ask the data, which of these competing theories do you find in has taken place? The examples I gave, you know, in public health, right, the benefits of vaccination. Public health is not a natural science. It's a social science because it deals with how people interact. You've got to make you have to have certain ways of identifying causal effects. But the overwhelming consensus in the epidemiology literature is that vaccination works, right? This climate change, it's a system with a whole lot of moving parts. We can't run experiments with a fake Earth and figure out what's going on. We've got to design models and figure out. And the overwhelming consensus in the climate change literature is that humans have caused the warming up, and it's going to get significantly worse over the next 50 years. What I'm going to say was the same is true if you look at the people who have done data-driven work, not sort of taking their priors and imposing it on the world as they see it, but data-driven work, asking the question, what happens when, for example, new market rental is built? It is overwhelming that it lowers rents or improves availability of accommodation.
Looking at the piece in the Sunday Business Post from only taking 2 weeks ago, showing, I think it was Mulheron's report, that the guy who, I think he worked for Tony Blair, and his thing said it does actually reduce, but it's, you're talking about to a magnitude of 2-3%. Because we need far more supply to be able to actually do the type of reductions or that we really need to see if we're being honest.
But do you not see that's on the same side of the argument? Is that what he's, and Ian has a particular take in the world that I don't necessarily think he's the consensus, but even by his argument and people who've taken up his argument, it is still a recognition of the fact that supply lowers prices. What Ian is saying is there hasn't been enough supply. I completely agree with that.
But you know as well as I do that as soon as that happens, the developers will stop building.
But why? If there's
no profit margin, they'll drop.
That's different. P minus C, profit minus cost, or price minus cost, is not the same as supply and demand. So somebody like me has been arguing for 7 years, at least, I should probably stop counting, that the construction costs in Ireland are too high. Right. And what I mean by that is whether you're for-profit or non-profit or state, it doesn't really matter, is that the cost of providing accommodation relative to everyday incomes is just out of whack. At one stage in 2016, the minimum spec two-bed apartment would have only been affordable for the top 10% of the income distribution. That is just not a way to have a sustainable construction sector. Right? What you're talking about is the viability of accommodation. And you can change the viability by changing the financing model. And I think we should certainly explore options around that. And certainly, say, cost rental spread out over 50 or 70 or 100 years is a really good way of tackling the problem of high housing costs in the social housing sector. But what you can't do is say just because supply comes on, more supply won't come on. That's not how it works. And more particularly, 40,000 rental units are in the pipeline. So clearly, if you're in sort of the 30 to 35,000 range, you don't worry about the other 30,000. You think that even with those 30,000, if you get into the market, you will be able to service the market. In other words, you can cover your costs with the rent that you get.
But the supply you're talking about tends to be high end, tends to be, you know, and again, I'm not saying the built to rent units aren't built to a certain standard or built, you know, there's, I'm looking down Griffith Avenue as I come up and down the road and it says, a new way of renting. And, you know, as well as I do, Ronan, people would have taken their hands off to buy a place on that. So
it comes back to the issue of cost, right? It costs about €650,000, including site, to build a build to buy apartment. There's not that many people that can afford a 650 grand apartment.
But we need to. So we get under that and we say, what's this?
Exactly. Now you're speaking my language. We find out why it costs 650 grand to build a two-bed apartment.
I'm always speaking your language. I'm just usually way ahead. but it doesn't. Houses can be built outside of Dublin for 200, 225,000, they can be built and delivered. They can be built and delivered in other parts of the country for less. And they've been built, as you know, up the road in Ballymun for less than that again, albeit with the land effectively gifted from the state.
And this is the thing, right? You get into your 650 grand figure, right? And some of it's going to be the side cost, right? And for an apartment, say, in Dublin, you might be talking 50 or 60 grand, maybe 100 grand in the most expensive locations in terms of site costs. And you've got your hard construction costs after that. But then you have other things that you say, I give the example of the housing in Ballymun. Firstly, it's an incredibly low density use of an urban space, right? Like we need to be able to build higher densities at a price point that's affordable for people on normal incomes. So
we're not bad at density, Ronan.
We don't have the luxury of taking valuable sites, like valuable to society, scarce and valuable sites inside the canal, say, and putting two or three stories there. We don't have that luxury because the scale of the housing need that we are going to have as a country over the next 50 years, we already know it's there, right? But we've built some of it up over the last 10, 15 years, and it's going to keep coming over the next 30, 40 years. And we just, as I say, we can't afford from a climate perspective to just tell everyone, do you know what, you don't get to live in Dublin. You get to live in Longford and just make it work. We need to. Sorry, Martin, come on in.
Yeah, just. I mean, I've listened to both Mel and Orla talking about this, and they've said that there is no reason to go high in Dublin. That we don't, in comparison to other countries, we're not unfavorable. That we do have the same kind of density that you'll find in other countries.
We're marginally behind the EU average. Yeah, so let's take an EU average of I think if you compare us to say the likes of Berlin, Amsterdam, and that we are about 3 or 4%, 5% behind them in terms of density levels. It's important to point out, you say between the canals, there's plenty of still sites available between the canals that could occupy about 40,000 units, I believe, at last count.
But that's 2 years
for supply. Dublin. Yeah, yeah.
2 years. We need to think about 50 years of supply. Like the volume. Like it's simply not. Like you can't take Berlin, which is spread over an incredible area, and compare it to Dublin. And Berlin is going to grow somewhat over the next 30 years. Dublin is going to grow significantly over the next 30 years and say, is there anything comparable? Right? Berlin has 60% of its housing stock in apartments already that are 4 to 6 stories. Dublin has about 20% of its apartment and stock. The typical city Dublin size in Europe has 2/3 of its accommodation in apartments. The reason why is that cities are home to 1 and 2 person households. Where do 1 and 2 person households live in Dublin? They live with each other. They live 6 students in a 3-bed or 4 young professionals in a 4-bed. We just don't have the type of housing we need. And I know, like Mel and Orla talk about, and they're right, that if you go to 6 stories, there's a certain cost. And if you go to 8 stories, and only 8, you're going to end up passing a threshold of cost and it's going to be higher per unit. Now, if you go to 12, you're actually, the extra stuff you have to put in once you go past 6, that starts to get spread over a bigger number of units. But in some ways, it's missing the point. The point is not that if we allow 12 stories to get built, everything has to be 12 stories. The point is that if we allow 12 stories to get built, 12 stories will get built where it pays for itself, as in we take the land rents from the wealthiest who want to live in the tall buildings with the nice views. We take the land rents from those and we use that to pay for housing elsewhere. That's the kind of system I'm talking about. Not that, like, the thing is, you go to Spanish cities and they have 6 stories everywhere in the middle. And the nice part about that is, right, you go in, maybe slight exaggeration, 4 to 6 stories pretty much everywhere. The nice thing about it is it creates a huge amount of cheap commercial retail office space on the ground floors, because there's just accommodation everywhere. So you get small boutiques and all sort of the mix of stuff. There's a lot less kind of chain stores there. People talk about it and say, like, why can't we do that in Dublin? I mean, we could talk about doing it in Dublin, but what you'd have to do is demolish existing housing to do it. You can't get an average of 6 stories when 80% or 90% of the space is covered at 1 or 2 stories. But if you really want to try and pull the average up, the marginal housing stock we build has to be taller where it pays for itself. Again, this is not by diktat. Just allowing something to be taller than 6 stories doesn't mean everything has to be taller than 6 stories. If it doesn't pay for itself, it won't get built above 6 stories.
I think there's a big argument to be had about certain parts of Dublin where high rise is an option. Absolutely. I think it really is. But I mean, the city itself is tiny, Ron. It's a, you know, the actual city part of it, and where it becomes hemmed in by 4-bed semi-detached houses, it's only a couple of kilometers of space.
Exactly.
And you so the change of usage in those, that's not, you know, we're dreaming if we think we can do that. But we also have to acknowledge that when we try to, like, when we look at house prices going up by, I think it's reported today, 10% again in the last year. And, you know, this, none of this makes any sense in terms of a model that, you know, I think you put it yourself in the report that, you know, coming into 2019, supply was actually starting to turn a corner in the article that you wrote. That was you'd fallen into that. But I looked at the actual delivery of units, and again, I'm going to pick on local authorities here, but it's pretty abysmal. I think if you go across all the county councils, and I mean local authority bills, it was less than 1,500 homes in 2020. You know,
yeah, well, the thing is, like, not that we've just come onto the topic from what I'm going to talk about, but it came up sort of earlier when I was saying, like, let the let the private sector look after the highest income portions of society, right? There's no point in us getting the richest 30% and giving them a subsidy with social housing. Let the private sector handle, I would say, the top two thirds of the income distribution, and let's focus the efforts of social housing on the bottom third of the income distribution. But to do that, it goes back to, as you said, Tony, like what is under the hood? Like you've got to go a third of the income distribution, reverse out what they can afford to pay in terms of construction costs, and then see how far that is from where we are. But what I'm not arguing is, just because I'm arguing that the private sector has a role to play in meeting our housing need, I'm not arguing that the social housing sector has no role. In fact, quite the opposite. I've been pretty clear for a number of years now that I think the state should be providing, might be too strong a word, but certainly supporting the housing needs of between 10 and 20,000, probably 15,000 or so new homes every year. And that's, I mean, I don't know of anyone who's arguing for a higher number. I think I had a Zoom conference with Owen O'Brien maybe last year. And I think he thought I was going to come up with some lower number. I had an estimate of housing need. And in the end, he rounded up to the number I had. And so it's not in any way that I'm arguing that the, far from it, the current system is adequate.
Well, then can we get to the current plans on housing for good, or housing for all, if that's okay? Because the numbers then, as I see it, in terms of social housing and cost rental, they're not enough. I mean, we're talking.
It's interesting you say that, because Rory had an article in the Irish Examiner
yesterday, probably.
No, it's just before Housing for All, where he was like, we need to double our housing, social housing spend from some roughly 2 billion to roughly 4 billion.
Oh, the spend is there. The spend is there. But the misallocation of that into what you called support, I see as subsidies in many ways. And like, so I gave the example. So South County Dublin built 100, again, it could be off by a couple of houses, so no one jumped down my throat. But last year, they built 109 homes.
And Martin's on mute.
And in total, they put up 275. So, but they bought 275. So they bought, two and a half times what they actually built. And this is another issue here, whereby the state are then competing in the private market to buy homes for a social and affordable home as well. So we're using that money, which we've used a big budget, not as much as the ESRI said we could have gone to, but nonetheless, a sizable chunk of money, the largest in the history of the state. You know, we've heard all the cliches, but we're using it, I would argue, not in the most fiscally responsible way.
I think, I agree. And like, you look at the fraction of homes bought per year, and in some ways, the government did a remarkable sleight of hand earlier in the year when, and I mean government sort of not actively, it was sort of all accidental sleight of hand, and the government in the state really more than the central government, because it was one of the local authorities had said to the developer in the infamous case out of Maynooth, if you build this, we'll take all of your units. And then halfway through, said, actually, we'll only take half your units. And the developer was like, what? I'll have to go and sell the other half, I suppose. And then came along and said, actually, we've changed. We're not going to have any of them. At which point the developer was like, what? Like, I only built these because you told me you were going to buy them. So I'm going to have to go find another buyer. And the whole incident that, homes being taken out from under the, and of course, I feel sorry for the people who had put deposits on those particular homes. That was like a state manufactured issue. And it speaks to the role that the state has in the purchase of homes.
I'd say it was
two and a half times the level of funds in terms of activity in the market. And the funds overwhelmingly, and in this case, that was a particular example, and the circumstances are very unusual. Overwhelmingly, the funds are funding the construction of homes that otherwise wouldn't be built. Whereas the challenge though for the state.
Do we know that, Ronan, that they wouldn't be built?
Well, again, who's going to pay 650 grand for an apartment?
Oh, but if there's no, if you remove the globalization and financialization of housing too, and we put it in a box, and again, I go back to your argument, say we can't test this over here. We don't have another planet to test the climate change moves. So it's but if we put it in a box and the worker still exists and the capacity still exists and the demand still exists, surely then we have some form of other ways of actually doing this that reduces that.
Yeah, well, I mean, and again, it comes back to, like, I approach this from, okay, suppose we have, for simplicity, we have 100 people that we're trying to provide homes for. If it were that, oh, that were that simple, right? We call them 100. I think of this as, okay, well what fraction of those are going to need, what fraction of those should we target for state support? And what fraction should we try and have as sort of self-sufficient, that they cover their own costs? And that includes the cost of capital, right? Capital has a cost. Even if we set it to zero for a particular project, we still, you know, it has an opportunity cost. So I don't, as I said earlier, I don't think we should be subsidizing housing needs for people on adequate incomes. They should be able to make their own way in the market. Now, what you've described there is a very good, absolutely a very good model for example, cost rental, that you can get housing, the state can borrow, the housing finance agency can borrow at whatever, 1% over very long time periods. And you can take your 650 grand, and suppose it was 1%, you're basically spreading that out over 100 years. You only need to get back 6.5 grand a year. Well, that's a phenomenal deal if we could get it. And the government should certainly be doing that. And should be doing that rather than competing with first-time buyers or competing with those who are trying to build rental accommodation, private rental accommodation.
Can I ask, Ronan, and I'm going to take it from Dermot Desmond's point of view, and he's a guy...
Dermot Desmond.
He's a guy involved...
But guess with that mustache.
He's a guy involved in finance. He talks to the money people, the riots, the vultures, whatever you want to call them. He talks to them. And they're saying that our government is being laughed at for their housing policies in this country. Now, that flies in the face pretty much of what you've just said. So is he wrong?
No. So Dermot Desmond had a very specific point, which he elided a little bit with a more general point, which I think is down to his personal circumstances. So his specific point was that the social housing policy, the long-term leases, is a bad deal for the state, because the state can borrow at 1%. And if it's paying 5% yield for social housing and not owning at the end, that's a bad deal. I'd agree with him on that. Now, into that, you can elide a more general criticism of housing policy, which is down to where he lives and a proposed development in the area. He and his wife have been vociferous about not having new renters living in their area. Now, fair enough. That's he's entitled to do that.
But
we
is
don't
that
have to
is
necessarily
that,
listen
is
to that.
Is that fair comment, though? Is that because he wasn't talking specifically?
Well, you said
about
housing policy in general. His article, if you read it, was a very specific criticism of one element of social housing policy that I think many people would share. I certainly am not going to say that I think long-term leases at 5% is a good way of doing it.
Enhanced leasing, which, if listeners recall, was introduced under the previous housing minister, Owen Murphy, and was wrapped into rebuilding Ireland. It wasn't in rebuilding Ireland initially when Simon Coveney launched it. It was added later on, and it is money for old rope for a lot, if you can tie in a 25-year term. And we've seen it across the road in Finglas, where apartments were sold as a block, 32 apartments ripped in, and they were buying it, I think, for the entire portfolio for 3.2 million, going to lease it for 25 years, get their rents for that yield, and still maintain ownership. It's a phenomenally successful...
I'm not 100% sure what you think I might say in the situation. No. I've certainly never thought that we should be relying on the market for providing social housing. That's a sort of an oxymoron when you think about it, because the market will provide, by definition,
okay,
pro-cyclical. Housing needs to be counter-cyclical.
Can I flip that question, though, and then ask you, because you made a point saying that, you know, there's maybe two-thirds of people's housing need could be met by the market and maybe one-third by the state. If I look at we had shrinking inequality between 2011 to 2019. We actually had a slight widening of inequality. 2020 is going to have to be taken with a big bag of salt, because we don't know yet until all of that washes out for a while. But we also do know that there was a small minority, I don't know, a large minority, I think it's somewhere between 38 and 41% of households that actually needed some form of social transfer to be lifted out of what's known as the at-risk of poverty threshold. So if we're at that level, the state really needs to be playing at that level as well, Ronan. It needs to be nearly closer to the 40% mark.
Yeah, I mean, look, to be honest, that I would like us as a society to be talking about that number. Is it, you know, is social housing, should the state be trying to help 10%, 20%, 40% of the income distribution meet its housing needs? That's your starting point in a way. Like, what is our preference as a society? And if it's 40%, that's fine. Now, that will mean that we'll have to devote more resources than if it were just 20%. But that's fine. That's a decision we get to make as a society. It still means, though, that the other 60% should be able to fend for themselves in the market. There should be enough, the viability should be there.
But they can't.
But exactly.
And there is no prospect of that reducing. There is simply no prospect of that coming down.
And this is why, like, in, you know, there's very little... very little reward in the way academia is set up currently. Very little reward for doing policy stuff, right? The reason I do policy stuff is because I care about this. The reason I've been arguing for, as I say, 7+ years that we need to understand what's going on in construction costs is precisely, Martin, for what you just said there. The system is not working. We've got a market that can only provide for the top 20%, perhaps, social housing that is at best trying to do 10%, if even. And what's going to happen the other 70%, I'll do some quick maths there, the other 70% are not getting served by either segment. And that's why I come on podcasts like this, that's why I write stuff in The Currency, whatever, is because we need to get back to the key points rather than getting sidetracked into ideological blind spots about, for example, claims that supply, that new supply will increase rents. And that's just, like, that's such a dead end from a housing policy. Like, if that were true, why don't we start demolishing stuff to lower rents? It's just not the way it works. We need to get back focused on the facts, which is that we have a supply shortage and a cost problem.
Can I move us on a little to UBI?
Sure.
And you have an interest in UBI, and I have it, myself and Tony have an interest in UBI.
You should pay the podcasters.
To me, UBI and pensions are intrinsically linked. A pension is basically a UBI. That's what it is. Intrinsically linked.
And child benefit is sort of like UBI at the other end.
Yeah, absolutely. So the government's move to increase the pension age, that's counterproductive. We're looking at a future, and I think by all reasonable counts, where there is going to be less workers. You've got robotics, you've got AI, you've got climate change. So you're looking at less consumption. And that's the way the world has to move if we're going to look at the event horizon of climate change. But making people work on into mid or late 70s, that's counterproductive for a society that's trying to consume less, that's trying to be leaner and greener. What they should be doing is reducing the pension age, not increasing it as a UBI method. The idea that you're going to have a workforce that's dominated, and I mean dominated at the top end by people over 70 years of age, is outrageously nonsense. Outrageously nonsense.
Well, so the problem here is a problem, like, as you say, they're intricately linked. The pension issue is around demographics. When the pension age was decided, life expectancy was 65. So,
well, actually, you know, I've had this argument. No, when the pension age was decided back in 1908, the average age a person lived to was around 50 years of age, and the pension only kicked in for those over 70. So when the pension first was designed, it was never actually designed for people to retire. It's if you survived a certain length.
Yeah, sorry, your point is stronger than I was. I was like, they're roughly the same, but you're right, actually. It was. But we now have a situation where you might start work, you know, like these days you're expected to go to college. Often you're in certain sectors, you're expected to do a master's, right? You might start work at 25 and you're going to live till, I mean, realistically, younger people these days are going to live till 95.
Well, I don't know. You know, I would disagree with that, in that this is the first generation that's worse off than their parents, and life expectancy is dropping.
No, life expectancy is still increasing and increasing faster than any projections.
Oh, it has dropped.
There was a drop in 2020. Yeah. But if you look at the every single decade, life expectancy has increased faster than projections. Everyone always thinks life expectancy is going to tail off.
It's like our corporation tax rates. We always say they're only going to be this level and they come in a lot higher.
And it's sort of a joke among demographers that they always make projections that they couldn't possibly keep going up. And yet it does. And the challenge for us is that we are going to have perhaps half of the people born that we're expecting our third child next month.
Congratulations.
That child, all going well. Thank you very much. All going well. That child has a 50-50 chance of making 100. Right, that's extraordinary. Now, in that setting, right, that they're learning till 25, the question is, where do the resources come from to provide for their living?
That's a good question, and that is the question.
Yeah,
and that is the question.
And to me, it doesn't seem unreasonable for someone to work half of their life. Right, so you work from 25 to 75. The first 25 years, you have one system of provision. The last 25 years, you have a different form of provision. Now, it seems like I'm sort of arbitrarily splitting out now and saying like pensions are reasonable, but I think also UBI is reasonable. The challenge with UBI is that we don't have the taxation system yet to support it. So I think for me, the logical first step is a negative income tax, that you decide some level where that's like the minimum you think is a reasonable standard of living in society. And I would probably, you know, of course I'd say this because I'm into housing, I'd probably have housing as separate. You have a housing system of provision, like cost rental with an income subsidy for housing. And then you've got your other stuff that you've got your non-housing consumption. But we should probably start with a negative income tax and move only to UBI when the resources are there.
Okay, can I just pull you back a little? You're saying the tax, and this is the same with pensions, the taxation system doesn't support. It doesn't support. But what we're doing, or what our government is doing, is moving to raise the pension age for people now who are not just born, who are not going to live to 95, who are not all college educated, who work in manual hard labor, for whom 75 as a nurse or as a bus driver just seems entirely insane. Insane. But the question I have is, where was the conversation that we had? Where is this conversation that we've had that said the solution to this is to work longer? As you said, the tax system doesn't support it. Is the conversation should not, or should it include, why don't we change our tax system to support it?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're asking the right kinds of questions. Right? We as a society, unfortunately, Martin, you and I don't get to decide this individually or collectively even.
But we haven't even had a conversation.
I also think it's bananas that we have sort of mandatory retirement. Like you take someone.
I agree. I think it should be choice. I think if you get to 65 and you want to retire, you should be able to do so without being penalized. If you want to work on, if you have what we call a career rather than a job, and you want to work on, that also should be your choice. But the idea that everybody has to work on into their 70s is insane.
Can I enter for a second? Because I want to ask both of you, actually, because Martin, I know you're referring to the fact that the state's failure to collect certain taxes, whether it be in recalcitrant industries where there are, you know, layers of levels of self-employment where we maybe term some of it bogus self-employment. And I also think, Ronan, it's important that we point out that only recently, the Taoiseach just said that he's uncomfortable with his own government's idea of collecting more self-employed PRSI over the next year. You know, it's supposed to go up between now and 2030. So we do have an unwillingness, it does seem to me, and to collect taxes. And again, you know, I think we keep saying we have a really progressive taxation system, and that's true when you look at it from, you know, where we go from the highest income inequality gross, and then it becomes net after social transfers. We jump up to the middle, so it does a lot of heavy lifting. But we're missing a trick here when there's a failure to collect taxes, and I suppose we're having even a broader conversation because we have to bring into the net now what the changes globally are going to be like on the corporation tax field. So I think even
at that, Tony, you can bring in the Panama Papers and the Pandora Papers, and we're looking at trillions that are offshored by very wealthy people and organizations. And then you have our government turn around to us and say, well, you have to work longer. Well, and I've tweeted this and excuse me. Well, go fuck yourselves. And that's what I think.
Well, the problem is, I think, and I'm not, Martin, I'm not accusing you of this, but is that we tend to look for silver bullets. It's like the solution to our longevity, right? The fact that we are now living increasingly into our 80s and our 90s is not that we'll have to work longer, but that, oh, it's okay, we can just sort of tax someone over there behind the tree that we can tax and that'll solve it.
But there is trillions. There is trillions behind the tree. Trillions.
Well, it's not trillions for Ireland, though. And that's the thing, is that...
We facilitate so much.
Oh, yeah, look, don't get me wrong. I'm in favour of wealth tax. And I think we should start with a land tax because it's the one form of wealth that can't be moved. To do a wealth tax properly, you'd need proper coordination at OECD level. And I think the corporation tax stuff is probably the first step in that direction that, you know, and Gabriel Zucman did some really interesting work where it's not actually organizations that are hiding it. It's individuals. It's households that are hiding it. Because he looked at the missing wealth of nations, I think it was, and he looked at the assets and the liabilities for households, governments, and corporations, which are your three sectors in your national accounts. And everything matched up apart from the households. The households had a lot more, if I'm remembering this correctly, had a lot more liabilities than they had assets, which of course was the assets getting hidden somewhere. And so to do a wealth tax properly on mobile wealth is going to take effort. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. It's just not something we can do easily, unilaterally, and hope to have big success. But we could certainly start by taxing land. Can't move
yeah,
that.
Just well, okay. We I'm conscious of time, Ron. I really appreciate you giving us the time. So you've mentioned land. We have to talk about the fact that in the budget we move from an ineffective 7% vacant site tax that they couldn't collect to a zoned land tax of 3% that we'll collect, you know, some part in the future, two years lead in anyway. What was your take on that? Because I know it got several guffaws around the Dáil when it was read out about the commencement date, when, you know, my petrol went up that night at midnight, but this thing's not starting for a couple of years. It does seem a little bit to stick in the craw.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, I don't know if the finance bill's been pushed, I haven't seen all the details yet, but my understanding is that what the concern was not around developers, the concern was around farmers, that you want to give farmers who are sitting on zoned and serviced land the opportunity to decide, like, are you actually farming this or are you going to develop this? Because, you know, heaven forfend, an Irish political system would take on the agricultural sector at some point. And my understanding is that was what was driving the consideration. Now, I think, you know, some people have made this kind of simple comparison. There was a tax at 7%, there's a tax on 3%, this is going to be worse. I have a different view in that the 7% tax was awful. It was awfully designed. I knew from the start it wasn't going to raise much revenue. All you had to do was show some kind of use on the site and it was no longer vacant. This is not that. This is a zoned land tax. If you are zoned and serviced, and I do think there will be some interesting court cases around the definition of serviced, I would have probably just done it for all zoned land. And if you don't want your patch of land zoned because it's not serviced, go off and apply to the local authority to have it de-zoned if it means that much to you. But anyway, I didn't get to decide these things. Someone else does. But a 3% land tax is quite a high effective rate. Because I was having a discussion with someone, a journalist actually on Twitter during the week, and I don't think they got this point. They were sort of laughing at me for saying 3% was a high rate. Because if you think of a plot of land and the imputed income, the income that you would expect to get from a plot of land, typically it's about 5% yield on your site. Like I said, it's going to vary a huge amount, you know, type of land and location and stuff, but 5% is not a bad rule of thumb. So you've got a site worth a million, it should be getting you around 50 grand a year in income. Right, that's the way a tax man would think about it. And how much of that 50 grand do you want to tax? Well, if you want 100% tax rate on that, you take all 50 grand. That's what a Georgist land tax supporter would say. Take the whole damn thing. Now, if you got a 3% tax on the value of a site, you've effectively got a 60% income tax on the imputed income for zone sites. I think it's going to actually have a big effect. I think there's a lead-in time, but the lead-in time itself, the fact that it's coming down the tracks, will get things moving. It's not early, sort of late 2021, early 2022 is probably like the last time you want to be trying to coax a construction sector to do stuff, because the capacity constraints globally are unreal. So I think a longer lead-in time makes sense there. But actually, I think it's a big step in the right direction. I'm quite sort of optimistic that if it goes well, we could go much further with a land tax.
And just last question from me, Ronan, and I'm just going to draw it back to the budget a little. We have what I call event horizon issues. We have healthcare, we have housing, and we have climate change. We're probably the three most pressing issues, but nowhere in the budget were those event horizon issues tackled. Now, there was some chipping around the corners, but the big changes that are needed to tackle these issues just weren't there in the budget. Is your sense that we are going to hit a cliff wall at some stage and have to actually spend an awful lot of money on climate change because we're not doing it now? Do you see that coming?
Yeah, I mean, this is not unique to Ireland. It's not unique to our government. It's just in general, it is true. And John Fitzgerald got in trouble for saying this. He's the former chair of the Climate Change Advisory Council. Yeah. He said that the kinds of measures that are needed are not going to be popular with voters, which seemed like he phrased it maybe slightly strongly. It's like we need to be open about the costs of the measures that we are going to have to take to fight climate change. And I saw someone criticizing him. It was like, you know, how dare you talk about the costs of fighting climate change? It's like, no, if you ignore them and pretend they're not there and then try and spring them on voters and say, well, how come you didn't know we were going to charge 75 euro for a ton of carbon and your whatever as suddenly trebled in price? I think that we have to have, I don't know, sorry, I'll finish with this. I don't know how you do non-incremental things in a way that gets you re-elected. And ultimately, that's the system we work in, is that people are trying to get re-elected because they think they're doing the right thing. How do you say, do you know what, we need to wean off fossil fuels in 10 years, right? How do you do that non-incremental thing, given how dependent we are on fossil fuels right now? It involves somebody like me, right? Maybe everything is a nail when you've got a hammer. But to me, it involves what are effectively price changes, putting in taxes on things that are going to be extraordinarily unpopular. And that's why people don't bite. That's why the measures don't come in the budget, is because it's like, hopefully someone down the line will, you know, things will be bad enough that when they introduce it, they won't get booted out. That's kind of what the thinking is, I think.
Yeah, and I share that concern both of you have expressed, because I do think we're facing too much. And again, if you take that, you use the analogy if all you have is a hammer, all you see is nails. But I would think there's too much stick and not enough carrot in some of the conversations that we've heard, and people then feel very much so that, like, you know, when you see the money being put aside for retrofitting, it's 1,200 homes in a million homes that require it. You know, it's not going to get anything done.
And the requirement to have energy efficient homes, like newly built homes, is a good one, as long as you're not pricing people out, because if it's more expensive to build, obviously you risk pricing people of a certain income range out. But of course, it's only fiddling at the margins. If we've got 2 million dwellings and you're adding 20,000 a year, then it's the 2 million that are the problem, not the 20,000. I mean, not that we shouldn't be having energy efficient new stuff, of course we should, but it's how you target, Martin, going back to your thing, how do you come up with, and maybe it's a carrot, not a stick, how do you come up with a way of, say, 100,000 homes a year? But like, we're going to just do the whole housing stock over the course of 20 years. And yeah, that's not, maybe that's, we'd like to do it in 10, but it's going to take us 20 and we're just going to do it that way.
Yeah, but
the kind of thinking we need, I think.
Ronan, you go that way and then you say you can do that. It's a job creator. It's a way of actually improving climate action. It's improving home efficiencies. It actually would help with our initial stock of how we talk about housing, but it also, what it will do is, if we did it properly, is we'd be serious about it, because, you know, at the moment you see on post with these green loans and they call them low cost, and they're not low cost. You know, they're 6% or 8%. That's not really low cost in the current market. It's just
channeling my inner Dermot Desmond, you know, where the state can borrow for 1% over 50 years. This is Martin, going to your point, this is like a max 50 years issue, right? Like, we've got to sort this out. Well, you know, this will pay itself. This will definitely pay for itself if we make these things. What I would say, though, with just in my particular space on kind of the climate change stuff, like, I do think the, you know, the decarbonization of electricity and the electrification of transport and heating are like they're the three things that they're not my area, but more in my area in terms of retrofitting. The big challenge is capacity, is how we tap into the skills that we need. We're struggling. We're kind of bursting at the seams trying to build 25,000 homes next year. Is how we go from 25 up to 35 or 45,000 homes, while also taking on, you know, retrofitting 100,000 homes a year. That's a scale that we're not, like, I don't know how you increase the capacity. That's a big challenge, because it's easy for us to say there's win-win-win, and there are win-win-wins there. But how you pay for them, how you get the skills and the resources is perhaps not as easy as it looks standing or sitting at our desk.
I think we could sum that up and say, well, if you're going to fix these things, we wouldn't start from here. I think we can sum it up that way. Ronan, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. We always have an interesting conversation with you, Ronan, and I think our left is rubbing off on you as time goes by.
Maybe I was always that way. You just never knew.
No.
Speaking of causal effects, you're causally changing me.
Reminder, go to Eventbrite, check Tortoise Shack. You'll see the tickets are up there now. Buy them. You know, come along. We'll have a great night. I can guarantee you we'll have a good night. And I'm looking forward to seeing people in a lovely venue, particularly good venue for a podcast. And we will talk to you soon. Ronan Lyons, one more time, thank you for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And we hope to have another conversation again. And I know we got down a rabbit hole, but there's a lot more to come back to when we get another opportunity. Thanks yeah. again.
Martin, Tony, thanks very much for having me on.
Talk to you soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on